Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear once again from Jerry Bergen with We Five. We heard from Bergen last week as the sole feature of the program, but he really had that many stories. We're going to start with Donovan T. with the Letterman. Donovan has been with Letterman for right at 35 years now. Though he wasn't an original member of the group, he was still able to speak a bit on the history of the Letterman, how it all began.
Well, there's a couple of different stories that I've heard, you know, when people recant the origins of the Letterman, even from the original guys. They all have their own take on exactly how it happened. But basically, Bob Ingeman and Gary Pike had known each other and were singing together, I think at Brigham Young University. And Tony Butala had been in show business since the age of 8, actually doing television and radio and movies with a group in Los Angeles called the Mitchell Boys Choir. Anyway, they all bumped into each other in the Los Angeles area and decided to start singing together and noticed that they had a really, really good blend. And then they took on the name The Letterman. And Bob Ingeman's brother, Carl Ingeman, was working at Warner Brothers Records in Los Angeles, and he got him a record deal at Warner Brothers, but nothing ever really caught on with him there. I think they had one release that didn't really do what they'd like it to. Then Carl Ingeman moved to Capitol Records and got them some recording time at Capitol Records, and they went in and recorded a couple of things, and Capitol Records liked it, signed him. And their first hit with Capitol Records was 1961 with The Way You Look Tonight. And it all went on from there.
Wow. I don't know if I could say that this is the number one Letterman song in my mind when I think of you guys, but let's go back to the earliest that I was able to dig up on you, and digging up being reading your bio on the Letterman website. If you could talk about the Young Americans, okay? So I'm truly going back to the beginning. Talk about the Young Americans, what they are, your involvement, and really what a person does to join this group.
When I joined back in 1973, it has gone on to morph into a different organization than it is now. They still perform, but there's much more to them now. But back then, they were strictly a performing group. There was an A group and a B group of the Young Americans. The A group worked at Disneyland, 6 shows a day, 6 days a week. And then the B group would tour. We would either do concerts on our own in the theaters, or we would open for somebody. And it was the greatest opportunity in the world for me. In college, they don't teach you how to sing the way the Letterman sing, or Jack Jones or Sinatra. They don't teach that. They teach basically classical. But for the Young Americans, it was like going to college for what I wanted to do. A lot of the Young Americans were singer-dancers, and we could all dance, but some of us were lead vocalists that did most of the solos and lead parts in the show, and I was lucky enough to do that. So I got to work with Sammy Davis Jr. and Rich Little and Tony Bennett, and you just go down the list. We opened for everyone, did television shows with them. We're even on one of Bing Crosby's last Christmas specials. But it was great for me to be able to watch these people, these great stars, these great singers that we opened for up close and learn from them over a period of 4 years. I credit the Young Americans with me being able to do what it is I do today.
Oh my gosh, wow. I'm wondering if you could pinpoint one of these artists, and I'm thinking specifically of somebody that you would have opened up for when you were still young, and just by observing them, you know, if you open up for somebody like Nat King Cole, you would certainly, after that day, want to be emanating some sort of suaveness and just that James Bond cool that Cole had. Somebody like that in your history, in your development, I suppose, an unknown mentor, we might call it.
Not a good thing to meet one of your idols, because they aren't always the people that you think, but you know, we're all human. Mm-hmm. And some are even greater than you ever imagined they would be. I could list several for you, but the one that comes to mind first is Sammy Davis Jr., which we opened for many times. Such a hard worker. It was 99% perspiration on top of all the talent that he had. And he loved us because we worked hard and would often talk about us during his act to say, hey, you know, we in show business work very, very hard to make it look easy. And he said, these kids work harder than anybody I know. And he didn't have to say anything like that. And he was just as nice off stage as he was on stage. It wasn't a fake personality. Sammy Davis Jr., though he wasn't on all the time, he was that good person that loved life and loved music 24 hours a day.
Wow. One of the things that I remember about Sammy Davis Jr., this is going to sound bad for a second, because I'm bringing up a memory of always seeing him with a lit cigarette when he would get on stage. But as my recollection goes, he never hit it. He never inhaled from that cigarette. He just lit it, and it was sort of a prop that he needed, like Laurence Olivier's green umbrella or, you know, some thing like that.
Well, I can't speak intelligently on that. I never really paid attention as to whether he inhales or not. But you're right, he had it in his hand on stage oftentimes, not always. I'm going back to, you know, 45, 50 years here. I'm not sure that I can remember seeing him personally with a cigarette in his hand, but on TV and things I have and movies and whatnot, I don't know if it was a prop or not, but it was certainly accepted back at that time and certainly before we knew all of the things that it could bring on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess if I'm encouraging anything, smoke but don't inhale. So that's, there's a Bill Clinton thing right there. Well, okay. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Donovan T., who's been a member of the Letterman for 35 years. The Letterman will play alongside the Association and We Five at the Legends of the 60s Volume 2 concert August 17th at the Bonita Center for the Arts in San Dimas. The concert will be emceed by Scott Wood. The show is currently sold out, but information available at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. More on Donovan T. at theletterman.com. So now is still with your history there. This is now into the mid-70s. And again, I'm going pretty much straight from your bio on a few different sites. Mid-70s, 77-ish, you had a gig as a soloist at the Horn in Los Angeles. And you credit this performance or this time as a real opener to other things. But first of all, the gig itself at the Horn, what type of a show was this? Kind of a cabaret type thing, a showcase of the greatest hits of the day? What were you doing then?
Well, it was a cabaret, and it was a unique situation. It was started by a great man, Rick Riccardi, who was a vocal coach at MGM Studios for years and years. And he started a nightclub there in Santa Monica, and it became famous simply because of all the talented people that got discovered there. Jack Jones was discovered there, Vicky Carr, Jim Nabors, the list goes on and on. He would always have at least four singers a night doing sets, and then at least two comedians that he would pace out in the night. And anybody could come in at any particular time. I can remember seeing major stars. Bob Hope would come in. Harvey Korman would come in. All these great stars would be sitting right there in front of you that you'd seen on TV. It was just the kind of the place to go. Of course, I had worked a lot before then, but looking back, I was not as polished as I would have liked to be. But, you know, nowadays, I like to tell people, there's no place to be bad anymore. There's no place to find yourself anymore. You go from your recording in your garage of some song that you've written that catches on to a stadium of 20,000 people, and then when that hit's gone, you either have another one or you don't, and then you're gone to obscurity again. There's no place to really work up an act or to get a personality or find out who you are and the way you want to perform. And the Horn was perfect for that. I really appreciate Rick Riccardi to this day. You know, we were all starving artists in our early 20s, you know, trying to make it in Los Angeles, get a recording deal. And he would feed us, he'd pay us a little bit, but he gave us a place to find ourselves in show business and be seen. Like I say, a lot of people got discovered there.
So do you suppose, again, it was a matter of your voice maturing and that stage presence maturing, or was it the fact that people saw you and you got exposure? I guess I'm going back to the fact that you really credit your gig at the Horn as a real career opener to other nightclubs and the cruise ship industry, for that matter. Do you suppose it was because you were really honing your chops or because of the visibility? You kind of addressed both there.
I think it's both, but probably a little bit more the first thing there, to really do it night after night and find out what works. find out, you know, what persona you're going to have, what people will accept from you, what songs you should do, how many standards should you try to do in your set, or should you try to do some newer things or a blend, pacing of your show, humor, if you have any. Mm. You know, some of us don't, some of us do. Some of us think we do and we don't, but it's a place to find out what works for you.
I've heard many musicians, actually both vocalists and whether it's maybe the third trombonist on the left or whatever the case is, they've described the cruise ship industry that way exactly. It was a place to hone their chops and really discover what works well in a set and maybe better off and maybe more importantly, what does not work well.
To touch on what you said about cruise ships, when you're in Los Angeles, you're dealing with, of course, a Los Angeles-minded crowd and certainly Americans. But when you're on cruise ships, and I started doing cruise ships, I guess, back in 77 when Princess Cruises had the Love Boat TV show on TV and they only had three ships. Now that I think I've got 50. But you were working for people that didn't necessarily speak English, or English wasn't their first language. And if they did, they could be from England, they could be from any place in the United States, and a wide demographic. There'd be families there, somebody from 80 into 8 years old, and you need to have a little something for everybody to keep them entertained. And again, you just learn how to do that on places like the cruise ships, that's for sure.
Nice to have you mentioning both Jack Jones and the Princess Cruise Lines, because we've got Jack Jones, he's the one who sang the Love Boat theme. So I guess at this point you were also doing various nightclubs, and eventually you landed in Vegas sometime in the late 70s. And I understand this is actually where you first met the Letterman, but the thing is, they attended one of your shows?
That's right. I was at the Dunes Hotel, and right across the street was the Flamingo Hotel, and that's where the Letterman were appearing. Now, I was also in the main room, but I should explain. It was one of those giant shows with, you know, 75 showgirls and dancers and all kinds of things like that going on. And even though I sang through the whole show, I was very, very, very lucky. The producer of that show allowed me to do like a 14-minute spot all by myself. And it was the only place on the Las Vegas Strip, to my knowledge, ever that gave somebody who hadn't had a hit record a chance to have that much time on stage in a major showroom on the Strip, and it was very, very lucky for me. And now I know the Letterman like to say that they met me, but I'm not so sure that is absolutely true. I know they saw me. I know they came across the street and saw my show, but let's be honest, I don't think they came across to see a new singer. I think they came across to see all the beautiful girls and the extravaganza of the whole show and saw me quite by mistake. But that was like 1978. I was there, 79. But then I moved on to the Stardust Hotel, and that's when I got the call from the Letterman that they were making a group change. And I went out to Los Angeles the next day. The three of us sang, and we found that we had a good blend, and we shook hands, and that was been 35 years ago.
Okay, so it's not so much that you heard of a vacancy, and then it wasn't like a cattle call where there were hundreds of people auditioned. They pretty much knew of you, and you were invited out for pretty much a let's try this and see how it goes kind of thing. Do I understand that correctly then?
Yeah, that's a good explanation as any. Just, you know, having somebody remember me and call my number, and it's a who-you-know business and who knows you.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Back now to Donovan T. with the Letterman, and later we'll hear once again from We Five's Jerry Bergen.
Summer's almost gone. Very soon, you and I will say goodbye. And before too
next to Tony, you're the longest-running continuous member of the Letterman. You came on board, what, late 84?
In 84, yes, sir.
Okay. Well, now, one of the things that Tony has stated about the group, and this is that it's a group of three soloists that harmonize. That's a really cool way of looking at that, because we look at, I suppose, this is a trio, okay? And so we would think that you guys would be going up there and doing more of your stuff together. But the three soloing parts, I never really thought about that. And I heard the Letterman so much growing up with my mom's records and whatnot. And so I never thought of it as a solo type of thing. And so with that, I've got songwriting type questions for you. I read somewhere you've written 14 or more songs for the Letterman. Is that right?
I've written several. I really couldn't tell you how many. None of them became hit songs, even though they got airplay. After I joined the group, they were no longer with Capitol Records. And I don't have to tell you back in those days how important it was. No matter how good you were, if you didn't have a major label behind you, you weren't going to get airplay.
Right.
And so we would get fragmented airplay in certain markets, but never all at once national release and push that only a Capitol Records type company can do for you to make a song a hit. But having said that, in San Diego, I remember the best review we ever got, listings came out, and a song I wrote called One More Summer Night was number 2 behind Elton John's Candle in the Wind.
Oh, wow.
And we would do that in a lot of different markets where we would be in the top 10, but in different markets around the United States at different times. So there was never a way to really push that to make that a hit the way that things work nowadays. But I was honored to have them record some things for us. And I would like to, if I could, digress just a little bit about what you said. I found interesting that you were surprised, and I understand that, about the solo part of the Letterman.
Yes, please.
As you know, all of the Letterman's hit records were, of course, group songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they found out when they were working live, and they worked a lot. They worked every college in the United States, I'm sure, at least 3 times in the 60s. But I think you find out when you're trying to do a show, an hour and a half show, or even a 2.5-hour concert, that if you do just group song after group song after group song after group song, it can lose its effect. And it breaks it up for an audience to go down to a solo voice and maybe have somebody talk and introduce the song or some banter or humor amongst the three of them and do a solo and then do another couple more group songs and then another guy do another solo. It breaks up the show, gives the audience ears a little bit of a rest and a little bit of variety. And of course, once they found that dynamic in their live show, then they started doing some solos on their albums. But they were album cuts, and I don't know that they were ever meant to be or would ever have been released as solo records, but disc jockeys in the old days would take their favorites and play them a lot, and that wouldn't be just the United States, all over the world. There was a hit record for the Letterman as a soloist, I think it was Donnie Pike, and he was the second replacement in the Letterman, that had a hit called Morning Girl over in the Philippines. And it's one of the few times that there was a solo song that actually became a hit record in any particular market. And again, I'm rambling here, but Donnie Pike was Jim Pike. Younger brother. Jim Pike was the one that did all the high parts in the original group. There was actually a group change before Jim Pike left that brought in Gary's other brother, Gary Pike. Before that, it was Gary Pike and Donnie Pike and Tony for over a decade, I think. So he had 2 brothers with him working at all times. But the Pikes really had a huge, huge effect on the Letterman, and give them a lot of credit for helping keeping the Letterman going all through the 70s and early 80s before I came.
I'm glad you mentioned this song being popular in the Philippines. Might as well just, oh yeah, Kenosha, it was really big. But the Letterman at some point actually started including Filipino love songs. There's a special name for them too that I'm not going to try to pronounce. But these special Filipino love songs. And I'm curious, well, one, I suppose, if you knew of these songs before joining the Letterman, or did you join and suddenly it was like, oh, now I have to learn Tagalog?
That's exactly what happened.
Oh, no.
I had never sung in Tagalog, and it worked out that Letterman were doing a show at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco in the mid-late 60s, and Imelda Marcos and her husband were visiting the United States and came to see the show. And the Letterman had, I think, some airplay over there because Capitol Records was worldwide. It wasn't just a United States label. But Tony Butella, being in the Mitchell Boys Choir as a small boy, learned a Tagalog song and just happened to remember it. And when he found out that Imelda was there, the Letterman stopped the show and introduced them, as they would, dignitaries or celebrities, and then faked his way through with the piano player to do Dahil Sa'yo for Imelda. And it turned out that Dahil Sa'yo, which means because of you, just happened to be Imelda Marcos' favorite song.
Oh.
So she and then invited the Letterman over for a command performance at the Palace in Manila, and that started a craze over there that the Letterman were huge in the Philippines for many, many years. Here in the United States, after their first big hit in 1961, what was it, 1962, that the Beatles invasion came.
Right.
So it kind of, I think, put a damper on what the Letterman would have been without that particular phenomenon taking place. But over in the Philippines, the Beatles didn't hit there until 5 or 6 years later, so they had more of a foothold. And we still go over there and can fill an 8,000-seat arena in the Philippines because the people still love the Letterman so much there.
Wow.
Tony is a brilliant man, and if he hadn't made it in music, I'm sure he would have been a great success in anything he would have done. He remembers everybody, everywhere. He remembers every song and everybody's part in every song. He's just one of those guys that really, really is always a step ahead of you wherever you go, and he's great to have around because he's just so on the ball. We like to tease him that he's got a fairy godmother the size of King Kong, but if there was ever a flight delay or a plane problem or a weather problem, if you were with Tony Buttala, somehow the skies would part and the sun would shine and you would make the gig. It always worked out for him, but he's a very, very bright guy. And once you talk to him for a little bit, you would find out how fascinating he is and know that it's not surprising that he remembered that song from being an 8-year-old to do it that night. He's really something.
Yes.
When Letterman were trying to get started, they kind of considered themselves kind of a doo-wop group because that's
really
what was popular nowadays. And when they went to Capitol Records, you wouldn't get an album deal right off the bat. They would let you cut a single, and if you got some action on that, then you'd come back and do an album. They also had a system. They would try to put the song that they really, really wanted to push on the A side of the single, the 45. They would put the best song on the A side, and then they'd try to put a dog, they would say, a dog on the B side, so that the disc jockeys wouldn't turn it over and they would get split play. And instead of two medium hits, they wanted to have a big hit, because that's what really puts you on the map. So they had this song that they were really hot with, they wanted to do, called That's My Desire. They put that on the A side. Well, nobody seemed to like it. It was just another doo-wop song with another so-called doo-wop group. I don't know whose idea it was. Maybe it was the producer's idea. They put this old standard called The Way You Look Tonight. I believe that Fred Astaire, I think, sang in some 1938 movie or something, and put a little three-part harmony to it and put it on the B-side saying, nobody's going to play this little soft, sweet, romantic ballad. You know, they're just not going to do it. And some disc jockey, I believe it was in Detroit, listened to the A-side, didn't really care for it, but thought, hey, well, before I toss it in the can, I'll turn it over and spin it, the B-side. Well, the phone lines lit up, and all of a sudden, the Letterman found themselves as being billed as a soft, romantic singing group. And, you know, they always phrase their songs like a soloist. That's one thing that made the Letterman different from other groups, whether they were trios or quartets or not. They would never phrase like a choir or a group. If you listen back to their records, they phrased like a solo artist. And that's what caught on, and I guess you could call it a wonderful, wonderful accident for the Letterman, but it typecast them as romantic ballad singers. And even though in the live show we do all kinds of music, we don't just do ballads that would put everybody to sleep after 30 minutes, but that was their moniker. That was their flagship. That's what they do.
Excellent. On the tunes that we had, you know, you mentioned The Way You Look Tonight, and I love the B-side stories, that sort of thing, and seeing things like, oh gosh, Hurt So Bad. You know, in my heart of hearts, I just knew, of course, it was a Linda Ronstadt tune, and I always forget that it's actually Little Anthony. But this is another Letterman tune. Do you guys still have this in your repertoire?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And again, because of the pacing of a live show, and the Letterman were doing this long ago before I came into the group, just to keep the pacing of the show up, they would do a lot of these ballads like Memories and Shangri-La and Hurt So Bad and Put Your Head on My Shoulder, all these single hits that they had, they would put them in medley form. So they would do them in their show for the audience that came to hear them. But instead of just doing them one after the other, which would have been like too much sugar or too much pie or too much cake, it's too much of a good thing, and it would end up being boring in the pacing of their live show. So they would put them in medley form. But we still do those today. It's called Dancing with the One That Brung You. We try to do the type of show that we like to go see. And if I go to see a certain artist and they don't do their hits, I feel a little bit cheated. Now, if they want to do their hits and something more, I'm all for it. But you come to hear the hits, and we make sure that our audience goes home happy.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Donovan T. with The Letterman. The Letterman is part of the Legends of the 60s Volume 2, along with The Association and We Five, emceed by Scott Wood. That's coming to the Benita Center for the Arts in San Dimas August 17th. More on the concert later in the program, along with music from We Five, and conversation once again with Jerry Bergen. The Letterman truly is a group driven more by the words they're singing than the melodies themselves. But away from words for a moment, I'm curious if you ever brought a song to the table that was based more on a melody or even just a phrase of a melody, the tune itself, as opposed to the words that just hit you in the middle of the night kind of thing.
Every songwriter has their modus operandi, and I don't think you get to choose it. Some songwriters will tell you that the music comes first, and some will say the words came first, or they had a hook and then built the verses, or had an idea for a verse and then came up with the hook. It can come in any way, shape, or form. And I think the best way I've ever heard it described, it would be the common denominator for every songwriter, is that at some point in your career of songwriting, you finally figure out that you're just an antenna, and somehow, from somewhere, these ideas, these feelings, these words, this turn of phrase, this melody, this idea just kind of comes to you. And sometimes you'll write a song, an entire song, in 3 minutes. Yep. And sometimes there's a song, it just takes years. It just, you can't find the finish for it. You can't find the hook for it. Or you've got a great hook and you just can't seem to find a verse to get into it. But it can come any way, in any fashion, under any length of time. And it really is a mystery. I don't know that any songwriter will ever be able to capsulize it and capture it in a bottle and say, okay, here's the formula. It's different for everybody, and for each person individually, I think it happens differently from song to song.
Well, here's something that's common for, I think, most songwriters, whether it's one of those small spiral pocket-sized notebooks that, you know, you can have in your breast pocket, or these days you can have voice memo number 28 on your phone if you don't take the time to title them. Other times we have to just pull over to write it down before it drifts away ever so gently. So now again, I'm looking for a song of yours. If you can recall some time where you just really had to get over to the side of the road and write it down quickly, jump out of the shower and dry off your hands, whatever.
Yes, and I have many, many regrets when life did not allow me the chance to stop and write something down. Or I say, okay, I'll remember that when I get up, if you wake up in the middle of the night, or if you're doing something and you didn't, and you just hit your head with a hammer going, why didn't I write it down? I don't remember what it was, but it was great. But you're right. I think that's a common denominator for any songwriter. When you get an idea, or you just get a melody or a certain turn of phrase that you think, oh, that's the beginning. That could be a good anchor for a song, or that's the idea for a song. And you got to write it down, because those little antennas that pick up these little signals that come from who knows where, you know, they broadcast on their own schedule, and you may never hear it again. So it's very important. It's interesting that you would mention that. It's very true.
When you are writing songs that are intended to bring to the group, Do you ever write any that were, by design, meant for one of the other Lettermen to get the lead on?
No, I've never written anything with that particular criteria in mind.
Okay.
Again, when you get a song, whether it's yours or somebody else's, you get around the three of us, and you can, depending on what key it is, how high the high part goes and whatnot, you decide who's going to sing what part. And that allows me to touch on another interesting differences of the Letterman from most groups.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been in a group before. You didn't get assigned a part, and that's what you were. You were the tenor, you were the bass, you were the baritone, you were the second baritone, whatever. There you go. That's it. It's etched in stone. It's not that way with the Letterman. And again, I hope you can talk to Tony about this to see what the origin was. Now, Jim Pike with the original Letterman, I think, by and large, with his beautiful falsetto, he would have the high part on most of the songs. But as the group went on, we switch off all the time. I can tell you that since I've been in the group, that's the way it's been. Sometimes we'll switch parts in the middle of the song. And if we're doing our job right and blending right, you won't know who's on what part at any given time. And that makes it interesting for us. You don't get stuck just doing the melody or the low part or the high part. From song to song, any of us could be changing to the lead or the melody, then switch off to the high part on the next song. And it keeps it fresh for you. And you also get to use every club in your bag. You don't just sing in one part of your range all night. It really forces you to keep yourself in good shape from low to high. And then also being able to blend. You know, it's important to know which particular vocal line in any particular song is the featured line of that song. It isn't always the melody. There are signature lines in certain songs that aren't necessarily the melody in a Letterman hit. It's a really interesting dynamic, but I'm very grateful that I'm not stuck just singing one part all the time. We all switch off.
Truly. I would imagine that would really add to your personal longevity as well, as far as just keeping the voice in shape, because you're not just second tenor or first tenor or whatever. There's the duop assignments right there, those five very strict parts. That's really incredible. I think that's going to be one of the cool things, too, about being able to hear the music and then go see you guys and say, oh, okay, that's Donovan. Okay, didn't know that one. Here's a couple of side notes. Have you guys ever been on the Letterman show?
Yes.
Yeah, really?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not as a group. We did not go on. But when David Letterman was there in New York, I was actually found myself accidentally on the streets of New York and on camera in one of their little comedy bits that they were doing. You know, those little insane things that David Letterman would have people go out and do. And I found myself in the shot and got to see myself when I got home. But no, the Letterman were never on David Letterman. Interesting point that David Letterman was actually with William Morris, the same agency that the Letterman were with for many, many years. And they wanted to put the Letterman and David Letterman together for their packages on the road. I thought that would be a great thing. But it never really worked out. But when David got his show, there was an offer for us to come on to the show. And, you know, we basically work in high fashion, custom tuxedos and things like that. And during the show, we'll put on our letter sweaters for one medley of a few of the early hits. But it's not what we wear all the time. And he wanted us to come on and do some sort of a skit with our letter sweaters on. Of course, we immediately were excited about being on there because national exposure was going to be great. But our publicity agent, the Brokaws, told us that copy of the script. And it was one of those things, even though it was funny, it wasn't going to be a good thing for us because the joke was on us. It kind of made us look passe and stupid. And again, I don't think that was the intent of it, but that's the way it kind of came off. And we thought to ourselves, more people are going to see us that night on the David Letterman show being made fools of than will see us in the next 10 years in live performances. Maybe this might not be the best step. So it didn't work out that we agreed to do it, though we would have loved to have been on his show. That was just wasn't the right vehicle for us. So that's the long answer to a short question.
Okay. A couple of things to address really quickly regarding performances these days. One, I'm wondering if you have a standard opener. And of course, this may change, I suppose, whether it's a solo Letterman show or perhaps something like where you're sharing the bill with two other acts. Say the Association in We Five on August 17th in San Dimas, just to pick a day at random here.
Well, we do plan our show set with the area and the expected demographics of our audience in mind. If we're going to be playing a fair or someplace where we know there's going to be a high propensity of young people or younger people, then we will throw in some newer songs that we have. We'll always do the hit medleys, but if we also know that we're going to be playing, let's say, down in the Villages in Florida, well, we're going to make it heavy on the more tried and true standards and maybe leave some of the newer, younger type songs in the bag for someplace else. But we have a big bag of tricks and a big list of songs that we can choose from. But we try to discriminate and do the right songs for the right demographics on the right day. And you don't always get it 100% right, but we do have different openers. The first couple or three songs, we feel that people are just pretty much just kind of looking at us and sizing us up for the okay. first three songs. You don't get a second chance to make a good first impression. So we try to do our best, whether it's the opener or the closer and everything in between. We really try to do the impossible. We try to please everybody. And they say you can't, but it doesn't keep us from trying.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to glide in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together.
Do you still welcome audience members' photographs during the singing of Up, Up and Away? I understand that became the point where it's, okay, come on up, take photos. Does this still happen?
Yes, and again, that's under the heading of us trying to do the kind of show that we want to go see.
You can see
some entertainers, and they're fantastic artists. But after the show, you can feel like I could have stayed at home and listened to the record. They didn't really say very much, or you didn't really get to know them. It didn't break down that invisible wall. So not only do we go out into the audience, shake hands and sing and meet with people, and there's interaction with the audience, but we wanted to take a negative and turn it into a positive with this whole photography thing. And now, of course, the videos of phones and things like that.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You're not going to stop it, so you might as well make friends with it. And again, other artists, they have the right to have the show that they want, and I'm sure they've got their own reasons for not wanting flash photography and things like that. Mm-hmm. But again, we wanted to turn a negative into a positive, go down there, break down that invisible wall, let them know that we're just like them and we want to get to know them. We appreciate the people that take the time to come see us. And if letting them come down and take a picture with us during the show, it's only 3.5-4 minutes, and it's a lot of fun. And even though we take pictures after the show and sign autographs until the last person goes home, some of these people can't stay afterwards. They've got to get home for one reason or another. So this is their chance to get up from their seat and come down, and we'll take a picture with them. And whatever pictures we don't get during that song, we always promise them we'll get them after the show if they can stay.
And in the meantime, you've just made their night. You have given them the show that they've hopefully always wanted to see. Nice.
We hope we do that, but I'll admit to you that we enjoy it too. We really do like to get to know and touch and shake hands and look into the eyes of the people that take the time to buy a ticket and come down and see us. It means a lot to us. So whatever we can do to make them forget about the outside world and just have fun, that's what we're there to do.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. David Fleming in conversation with Donovan T. from the pop vocal trio The Letterman. You can find more on The Letterman at theletterman.com. Up next, we'll hear once again from Jerry Bergen with We Five. Just ahead, hear about how Bergen once found one of his recordings having been used heavily at a golf course, but it was being used as a frisbee.
Peter, in a meeting one day, decided that I won't get into all the personalities and stuff, but he was feeling like an odd man out, so he resigned. Whereupon Beverly said, Peter didn't quit. Peter was forced out, and if Peter's gone, I'm gone. She says, I'm gone. Whereupon Bob says, well, you know, we've got other people we know who can sing, and we're working on this and that, so we'll, you know, we'll just carry on. To which Werber says, no, Beverly, you guys are welcome to audition, but We Five will not go into the studio again until I'm convinced that you have something worth recording. Unless, and he looks at me, Jerry's wife will take Beverly's place in We Five. And nobody wanted Debbie around because she didn't do drugs. She was persona non grata at our session. And so they looked at me, and I thought, well, isn't this a fine fix? But I thought to myself, wait a minute, if Frank is willing to record her now, why don't we just say We Five has had its run? Debbie and I will go in and start, because we were already writing songs and stuff. We'll just go in and we'll start as the Bergens and start over. I asked Frank about that, and he said, sure. But within 6 months, and we were recording, and a bunch of that stuff is on Sing Me a Rainbow and on There Stands the Door. In any event, Frank got out of the music business entirely, gave me the masters for the stuff that we'd recorded and a letter of introduction, and Pete, who I had talked into singing with us, he just didn't want to be with some of the other members of the band that wanted to be a blues band. Pete and Debbie and I moved back down to Southern California, went to A&M and signed directly and put out the Return of We Five album.
That's when that is, okay.
And that was that came out in 68, but 67 is when it was conceived up in the Bay Area. I won't go into the sordid details of it, but we had a manager who got us out of the A&M contract and couldn't get us into the next thing he planned on doing. Then he got sick, and we went 2 years, and it was kind of over. And then Michael in 69 came and said, hey, can we do another We Five album? We did, and it's a really good album, but it was on Vault Records, and the guy who owned the record company died shortly after it came out. And in the old days of vinyl, if you didn't have a solid company, record stores would send it back to get their money back. And so almost all of the Catch the Wind album wound up at the Scranton Record Works in Pennsylvania, and they were melted down in to make more vinyl when the gas shortage came in 71. But it's a really good album.
Wow. This was in the mid-70s, and I'm not sure if this would be a variation or a version of We Five, or this would just be the Birkins, but Take Each Day as It Comes.
Okay.
Which ended up as a TV jingle.
We Five actually still exists because we're playing, and We Five, I'm the only continuous member from day one.
Yes.
Any record that's ever gone out with the name We Five on it, I was on it. And the Mike Stewart album was the Catch the Wind album, and we were working on a project with Michael when a recording studio took possession of masters because they realized how good it was, and they wanted half of everything or they wouldn't release the masters, and we were recording on spec. So we said, well, no way we're doing that. Then we signed with AVI, which at the time was Liberace's company, and Take Each Day was released on MGM. Well, Take Each Day, when Peter left the group in 1971, Terry Ragno took his place as bass player. And Terry Ragno will be the bass player at the concert that we're going to do in San Dimas.
Excellent.
And so it's a continuation of the same thing. First group was Beverly. Debbie joined the group in the Return of We Five. Mm. And the Return, Catch the Wind, and Take Each Day are all Debbie.
Gotcha. Okay.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing. Somewhere beyond the sea, she's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms I'd go sailing.
The other one that I want to touch, and I suppose this almost makes it a nice full circle, which is sort of a natural wrap. I'm looking at Beyond the Sea, which is, I guess, this was the B-side too. You Were on My Mind?
No.
No? Okay.
B-side was Small World.
Oh, okay, okay. Well,
and
there's
a cool story to this. It's quick.
Yes.
When we were pre-We Five, when we were, Beverly had joined the group, and we were at a rehearsal one day, I think down at her mom's house, and Bob was fooling around with how to count 5/4 times.
Okay.
And so it was a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, da 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 da, and doing the Dave Brubeck thing.
Sure.
And so Bob is kind of noodling on some chord changes, and Beverly's counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, and Mike Stewart starts going, funny, you're a stranger who's come here, come from another town. Funny. Bob stops dead in his tracks. He says, Michael, you're singing that in 5/4 time. And we continued on through and found out that we were able to hold 5/4 time all the way through the Johnny Mathis hit. We were doing the Bob Hope show one time, because it was on the flip side of You're On My Mind, and we played that song. And I don't know who the guitar player was, but it was a Barney Kessel, Tommy Tedesco, one of those guys, and he had a goatee. It was one of the two of them, and I don't remember. Came up to Bob and said, you know you're doing that in 5/4 time? To which Bob sarcastically says, no, it's an accident. Beyond the Sea was on the flip side of several things that A&M put out in that period when we didn't have a second hit. They were trying anything. Throwing records.
Gotcha.
I found a copy of Cast Your Fate to the Wind and Get Together in the bushes on a golf course in Mill Valley once in 1971.
Oh, no.
Where you know somebody was out there playing frisbee golf with records.
That's worse than finding it in the dollar bin. Oh, gosh.
Well, no, this one was warped. Correct. Beyond the Sea was actually my roommate in college's idea. He was at USF. Michael and I were there, and he played me, you know, the Mac the Knife was a hit, and Mike and I get together one day, and I said, you know, my roommate asked me whether we could do Somewhere Beyond the Sea. My roommate really liked The Journeyman, and he liked this, and he liked it. And so I said, well, let's noodle around with it. And so I started playing Beyond the Sea like it was a folk song, you know. And it clicked, and that arrangement was born. And so we start out with just an acoustic guitar, just me playing guitar and a bass, and then Bob drops in a backbeat rhythm on a huge F-hole guitar that he had. And then the banjo finally comes in, you know, and the whole thing lifts off. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool recording, and it was my roommate's idea.
Absolutely. Well, he loved the Mac the Knife. I guess you're talking about the Bobby Darin version, presumably, because this is maybe the biggest version of Beyond the Sea that folks would know.
Well, that's why he asked. He says, could you do this song like a folk song?
Gotcha.
So I said, well, let's find out. So I took the guitar, and it's got all kinds of chord changes and stuff. It kind of put a smile on our faces, and Michael and I started fooling around with it, and then Bob started adding this backbeat rhythm as we got further along with it. Anyway, that's where it came from.
That's way cool. Oh, that's more than I hoped for on that. I just wanted to acknowledge Django Reinhardt up to George Benson and you guys somewhere in the middle with that. Excellent.
Well, Bob was closer to Reinhardt than you might think.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. In fact, Bob got sick with pancreatic cancer and passed away, and he had lived in Hawaii. He grew up there. He had gone back when his mom got sick and bought the house that his grandfather had built. And
oh, wow.
I don't know. You might not know this. Bob played drums with Michael Bloomfield for 10 years.
I think I maybe have read it on the bio that's on the website. But no, I didn't really know that before
reading
it.
In any event, Bob was a very avant-garde thinker as far as music. And his first love was blues. But anything fascinated him. He was in the process of emigrating to Finland because he had a Finnish wife.
Oh, okay.
Where he could spend the last part of his life playing blues and jazz in Europe.
Wow.
And he didn't make it, which saddens me. Now I can't go visit him in Europe.
There's the gosh. Wow. Music from We Five and conversation with Jerry Bergen to wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. We Five, the Letterman, and the Association will be in the area soon as part of Legends of the 60s Volume 2, emceed by Scott Wood. The concert is reported to be sold out, but more information and an archive of pictures and past interviews at affordablemusicproductions.com. Thanks once again to Jerry Bergen, Donovan T., and to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Sharina Wad, Natalie Calmer, and KVCR Director of Operations, Tony Papa. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. Many past KVCRs can be found through iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play, and all past shows at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.